So you're listening to listener-supported community radio, WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, 89.5 FM. Lisa Sahulka with you until 4. And as promised, I have on the phone with me Michael Leonhardt. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. And so you're down at the Jazz Standard getting ready for your gig tonight, I think, right?
I am in the club. I just walked in with my charts and the horn and some stuff and just popped it down, and they said I could use the landline at the front desk. It's a lot harder to find landlines now.
Oh, can I tell you that that has been my nemesis, because I've interviewed so many jazz musicians that there's no landline, or, you know, they'll call me from a coffee shop. So this is like a pleasure that it's actually quiet. So let me ask you, first of all, I have this whole thing written about you, and I realized that I would have you waiting for me for 2 minutes, because your career has been so incredibly diverse, and you play so many instruments, and you've done so many recordings. And so I just thought, rather than do that, we would kind of walk through your career in the interview, rather than having you sit there and wait for me to announce all this wonderfulness that you have.
I'm all yours, whoever you want to do it.
Well, I appreciate that. So let me, first let me ask you, you're actually doing the Painted Lady Suite tonight at the Jazz Standard, is that right?
We're not doing the full album for the reason that it takes about 4 days of rehearsal to do the album start to finish. So what we can do is there's certain parts of it that I've adapted to be able to do live. We need certain doubles. The woodwinds need to play alto flute, bass flute. The violinist needs to play viola. We need the piccolo flute, etc. Percussion needs some extra instruments. So we're doing, I think on the set list, we have four pieces from the album, three from the suite.
Fabulous. And yeah. Are all 30 musicians going to be there? I mean, how are you working that out?
No, we have 17.
You know, I go to the Jazz Standard a lot, and I'm just chuckling because I know Maria Schneider, and there are other people that pull this off, but every time I think about 17 people on that stage, when really I think 3 or 4 is probably the maximum. So you guys are going to be squeezed in a little bit there, huh?
Technically, we're not only on stage. That's where I'll leave a little mystery, but that's, you know, the clue I'll give you.
Fabulous. Okay, well.
There are, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'd say about 11 on the stage
at the same time.
Yeah.
So, you know, this was a question that I was trying to avoid asking you, but I find myself that I need to get it out of the way, right? So, you know, you've had a career that's been so diverse, you know, Steely Dan, David Byrne, and then you had this whole other jazz life. And, I mean, do you see those two things as being complementary, separated? How do you think about it?
I don't see them as being separated. I see them as being two sides of the same coin, really. There's, at times, you know, depending on my lucidity and my fatigue, sometimes I see them in different ways, like two different paths. Sometimes I see them as like an A and B side of a record, one which is a pop hit, the other which is a B side and more esoteric. Sometimes I see it as pop music versus high art, but I do tend to see it as one or the other, which helps me just kind of separate the two. They're connected, but it's like flipping a switch. There's the idea of a friend of mine who was playing here a couple of weeks ago said his son came to hear one of his shows many years ago, and he said, "Dad, your music's great, but your songs are just too long." So that kind of sums it up. That
is hilarious.
With the pop brain, you don't want to go past 3 minutes. Nowadays, maybe past 2:50. With the other side of it, you can go 8-9 minutes. So it's sort of thinking either as the guy at the end of the bar,
yeah,
who really just wants to be entertained, who doesn't care about the esoteric part of the music, or the, you know, being having it explained to him why the music is so great, but just either likes the music or doesn't. And then on the other side, you have a music head who is ready to dissect and analyze everything, and somewhere in between is where I live.
Yeah.
And I stopped. I just came to grips with it many years ago that I have a foot in both worlds.
Well, your career has been amazing. And, I mean, I have to say, I imagine that Steely Dan was not so, so far away from the jazz universe that you populate now, right? I mean, kind of.
Yes and no, in the sense that at its core, Steely Dan comes out of rhythm and blues, like old rhythm and blues, and old jazz. And that's, you know, like Mingus, Ellington, Stravinsky. Those are really the root of Steely Dan. Bob Dylan, poetry, pulp fiction novels. So really interesting art that takes chances, but it was filtered through pop music of the 70s. Mm-hmm. Or you could say pop music of the 60s, the way records were produced, and then Donald Walter, as they developed into a band, they started filtering it into, no, we want this section of the song to sound like this. Now, I'm wary of using the word perfect, because nowadays people think perfect means perfectly in tune and perfectly on a grid and perfectly lined up in Pro Tools, and there's a different, you have to kind of change your perspective of the way you're looking at it, that it's about this groove that locks in and just hits you in the core. It's like the perfect kind of purdy groove, or this like the ultimate R&B groove or funk groove or pop groove. And having worked with them, I laughed the first couple times I saw Donald Walter in the studio when an engineer or an assistant engineer would say, I'm going to bring up the grid, you want to see where the kick drum lines up? And they'd say, no, we're just going to, we'll listen to it. So I went, okay, they're not listening with their eyes, which I love, but they're aiming for an extraterrestrial level of solidity and perfection and accuracy. So you're coming from the color and the tonality of this older music, of older R&B, Don Covey, everything, you know, out of Stax and Muscle Shoals and Blue Note and Riverside Records, but it's being applied with the touch of like a studio magician from the 70s, when technology was beginning to really blossom, and you had multi-tracking, and then at the end of the 70s, the advent of digital recording and early drum machines. So it's really, in a sense, yes, it connects to what I'm doing. At the same time, Donald would be the first one to say it's very different, because when he plays his music, especially in the studio, he's aware that he's fighting the beast of perfectionism at all times, and he wants to keep it at bay, but it's there. I mean, that's how you get albums like Asia and The Nightfly.
Yeah, and it is true. I mean, I know that you have a huge background also in putting music together, in addition to being a trumpeter and a multi... I mean, I wrote down all of the instruments that you're able to play, and it's quite...
Not necessarily all that well, but I've had to come to terms with the level that I play different things.
I mean, the accordion? I mean, come on. The accordion.
I love the sound of it. Don't get me started on the left hand, but the right hand, you know, if I get a little running start, I can do a little damage.
I mean, it's just a huge leap from the trumpet, the organ, the accordion, the bass. I mean, you must be very, very popular in the recording studio, because you could just pick up another instrument, yeah?
Or easily annoyable. I mean, like other people, you know, I hang out with a lot of people that... play a lot of different instruments. Now, that's not to say that I could play Giant Steps or Countdown on every instrument, but I grew up in a setting where it was like speaking five languages. When you grow up in a house where your parents speak different languages, you're not afraid to try different languages. In my house, there were a lot of instruments lying around. I was growing up in New York, where music was just everywhere. Everyone in my family sang, so you just kind of opened your mouth and sang. When there was an instrument, I just tried to bang on it. Then I played trumpet, which, as your muscles are forming, you can't really play it for more than 10 to 15 minutes. So my muscles would tire, and I couldn't make a sound, so I'd look around and I'd see a piano, or I'd see an upright bass. I mean, I didn't really play a lot of upright bass, but I played a lot of piano growing up in the spaces when my lips were getting blood back to them.
Yeah, you know, so I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah, so you're saying that, you know, particularly as you're learning the instrument, it takes a while to be able to play it for any length of time. So we should be very impressed when people are playing it for an hour.
Oh, it's an enormous feat. I mean, look at Lee Morgan, Freddie Hubbard. Would they make it look easy? But when they're taking, and Roy Hargrove was another guy who, when he would take 3 and 4 choruses at jam sessions, and 5 and 6 and 7 choruses, and keep on growing, the reason why he was crushing the other players was because they were like runners who were getting exhausted. He had developed a stamina and endurance to be able to start off and play something in the first or second chorus, then lay low in the third, then come back up and fly in the fourth, fifth, or sixth. That's to do that like a saxophone player, a guitar player, is pretty difficult.
Yeah,
when you go back to the bands of the 20s, 30s, 40s, it's pre, you know, bebop and hard bop, but people were playing a lot without microphones, so they, I think the ones who could survive and make a living developed a great technique to play longer periods of time, like Louis Armstrong or Roy Aldridge. But a trumpet is a hard instrument. I mean, Chet Baker didn't play super long courses. Gorgeous tone, but he wasn't built that way. Mm-hmm. Most trumpet players are not.
You know, I saw Dizzy Gillespie when I was in college for the first time, and you know, the actual seeing of his cheeks ballooning out like that, if I ever had to understand how difficult it was to play that instrument, I understood it right in that nanosecond. You know, it's just an amazing thing to see. And I suppose that comes from not actually getting the technique right, but who could say he was doing it wrong if he was so amazing at it, right?
It's not a textbook technique, but it makes sense how he did it. You could see how much air he was using, and he still had this very strong tight embouchure, so he just had a different way of doing it. Other players did that. I mean, Fats Navarro at times, there are some famous pictures of him where his cheeks start to billow out, but no one did it to the level of Dizzy.
Yeah. So, you know, I saw you interviewed at 17 years old, right?
Oh, boy.
And yeah, you know, you were on Charlie Rose, right? And so you show up,
yeah,
right?
You're those glasses.
Oh, my God.
My wife.
I thought you were cute as a button myself. But, I mean, my real point was that, you know, you're 17 years old. You've just won a Grammy. I believe you're still the youngest musician to ever win a Grammy. I think that's right. And
haven't kept up to date with it.
Yeah, I'm going to say that you are. Let's just leave it there, right? And so you're sitting there in front of Charlie Rose at that table, right, where all of these amazing people have sat. And I know, right? I mean, I almost didn't raise it for that reason, but it's just so interesting that I can't drop it. So, you know, you looked so sophisticated and so confident. And were you feeling that way, or were you scared to death?
No, I was pretty comfortable.
And is that because you had experience performing before, or that you grew up in a household where people performed? Is that where that courage comes from?
It's probably, you know, now that I have a son who's 9 and a half and I see how he's just crazily confident, at times, you know, a little more than
you wish.
But it's very natural. I see that I got it from my dad. My mother is wonderful and eccentric, and just like there's no real filter, which is part of it. My dad is just very comfortable, sort of holding court when he gets going. And for me, sometimes I get it's sort of like being on stage at times where when you're in the groove, when you're sharing something, you're able to just shut off the other part that would be analyzing or judging. Now, this is not always in life. I'm human, and I, of course, have those moments. But looking back to that period, there was so much going on, and at the time I was being shoveled around to these different things that I just did it. I remember Charlie was very smart. He was very interested and had interesting questions. So it just wasn't big a deal. It's sort of the joy of being 17, you know.
When did you start composing? Was that from the beginning, or?
Yeah, from the beginning, because it goes back to trumpet. Like when I played a little violin, and I'm told I had a good sound. I just didn't like standing up, which clearly wasn't the real reason, because all you do on trumpet is stand up. But I said I didn't want to play. Mm. Then I played drums, and I studied with a drummer named Bobby Shankin, who lived across the alley in my parents' building complex. But I didn't like practicing the pad. I wanted to play kit. So I stopped, and then I started playing trumpet at 10 and a half. And what happened is, again, I could make a nice sound, so I was playing and improvising. But when I would have to stop to rest is when I would want the flow to continue, and I would begin composing.
Mm.
Now, I remember that my dad had a Juno 60, which is a Roland synth from around that time. And I sort of co-opted it, and I had this great arpeggiator. And you could hit the button, and it would hold the chord. You played a C major 7. And
very nice.
Arpeggiated. And it reminded me of kind of like Eddie Harris and also some, you know, mid-century modern classical music. So I would do that, and then I had some sort of a Lesis 4-track, and I would record it, and then I would compose on top of it. And I started like that, and then I would notate things, and then I would play some more, and then I wound up getting my hands on some scores, Ravel and Stravinsky. And just as far back as I can remember, around 10 and a half, I was just writing down ideas and figuring out how to notate them, because I was so fascinated with, I guess, what you would call, you know, counterpoint, and having a melody. Okay, so then you notate the melody, and then underneath that there's a separate line that works in conjunction or against it. And then the beginning of harmony, and studying that, and sitting at the piano. So I was always composing.
So let's tell our listeners, we're talking to Michael Leonhardt, who is a composer, multi-instrumentalist, and he has a new album out that's on many, many people's top 10 list. It's called The Painted Lady Suite. And we've been talking about his father, who is Jay Leonhardt, and we know him well here at WPKN as a jazz bassist, and his sister is a singer, Carolyn Leonhardt. So your whole family has really... you know, taking on the musical world. I wanted to ask you...
Yeah, and my mother, Donna, made her first album at 60. I mean, it's everywhere. My wife is a beautiful singer and songwriter. My mother, my aunts and uncles play different flute. I mean, it's really kind of everywhere.
Do you take that... I always ask this of musicians. Is that, do you feel like, convinces you that it's a genetic trait, or do you just think it's the culture? You know, this is the nature-nurture question, I suppose.
I think it's both. I think that, you know, humans have occupied the planet for not a super long time, but long enough that it's really, if you look generationally, you could say that music has been in my, certainly on my dad's side, for quite a while. And his first cousin, Bernie, was a beautiful church organist. So it wasn't jazz, but he was improvising and playing fugues and, you know, reversing them and doing funny things. So there's definitely a musical thread. My dad's older brother, Bill, is a beautiful seven-string guitar player, and also plays harmonica.
Wow.
So I would tend to think that the gene is there. There's something in the hearing, something's genetic, and then as a result of that, someone in the family usually is interested in music and has instruments around, and then it gets nurtured. So probably, I don't know if it's 50-50, but I think it's a nice little dose of both.
Yeah, I hear that.
I'm seeing it now with my son, who his favorite thing is soccer, but he plays cello, and it's around, and he's at that place now where he doesn't have to look at his left hand as he's playing. And I'm going, wow, this is amazing. It's becoming second nature.
Well, it must be interesting to watch him blossom now that your dad has done that with you, right? I mean, so you're saying that you're seeing the whiffs of the Leonhardt clan in your son.
Yeah. Yeah, and then for my son, my wife's family, her grandfather was a cantor, and so was singing probably all the time, and so she's always singing. So who knows? You know, it's all and in many ways, my son sings more than he plays cello. But there's always, I asked him, do you spend most of the day with music in your brain? He said, yeah. So I went, okay.
Well, and that is definitely the trait of a musician, right? There's no doubt about that. I mean, occasionally I have the problem of getting a song out of my head. I mean, some of the tunes on your new CD had that quality for me, you know, where I've listened to the CD 20, 30 times at this point. It's just a fabulous thing that you've done. And I wanted to ask you, you know, a painted lady butterfly? I mean, how did this happen that you became so, obsessed? Sounds like a negative word, but I certainly don't mean it in that context. I mean, this is a big project that you did.
Yeah. Well, it started, I wrote about it on the inside a little bit, the CD, but I was on a field trip with my son probably now 3 years ago, I think when he was in first grade, end of first grade, and we went to maybe it was Central Park or the Bronx Zoo. And I was leading him and his classmates around. There were some other parents, and we passed a butterfly exhibit, and I saw the name Painted Lady, which I had heard a little bit, you know, throughout the years. But I saw one in the glass, and first I thought, wow, what a gorgeous butterfly. And then I loved the name of it. I thought it was very evocative. And later on, my wife, you know, and I were joking that there are multiple meanings for painted ladies.
Nicely done,
Yeah, and there's also the painted lady in architecture out in San Francisco, the painted lady Victorian houses and the A-frame houses,
yes,
a whole row of them. But I came back to the butterfly, and I made a note. I keep a notebook with titles and lyrics and different ideas. And so we continued on the field trip, and over the next couple of days, I kept on thinking, what a great name, and it just stirred something. You know, I was definitely starting to get ideas about it. So I did a little more research, and I thought of writing some sort of narrative that combined the female, the prostitutes, painted ladies, with the butterflies and the row houses, and I sat with that for a little bit, and I said, you know, that strikes me as a little convoluted. If it was going to be an opera, maybe, but let me see if I can simplify it. And then, so I studied up on the migration of the painted lady butterfly, and this was at a time, especially when migration was becoming a huge issue in the country and the world. And so I just kept on looking at the butterflies, and I thought, this is really interesting. They travel 6,000 miles farther than the monarch. There were all these things that were unknown, that they thought, oh, why don't we ever see them? They must be too small to see. And then they realized they're not flying at 200, 300 feet. They're flying at 1,500 feet up, higher than they thought and farther than they thought. So, and that it takes six generations to get from point A to point Z. So what is it that is passed down from one generation? One generation starts in El Paso, Texas, and flies northward, and that generation dies a little while later, and the next generation knows how to get to the next place, and then that generation, and so on and so forth. But that is fascinating for an animal that has a very small brain. How is this happening? So the suite is divided into two parts, two different migrations, one North America and the other one basically from the Arctic over Europe to Northern Africa.
You know, I think it's interesting because I was wondering if you were thinking about immigration when you were composing. I mean, how much of that is in this music, do you think?
Oh, it's absolutely in it. I mean, I don't know if it's obvious, but, you know, you can't, or you can stick your head in the sand and not be part of the world, but I have a son, I have a wife, I care about the human race, you know, being a father, I'm hopefully a little less self-involved, and I tend to look around at the state of the planet, and there's a lot of fear and confusion, so it definitely, I didn't dive deeply into it, but to me it felt very relevant to look at this little animal that starts off one place and leaves it, we'll never see it again, lands in another new place, and all for the point of just continuing the lifespan of future generations, going into the unknown. You know?
And tell me what it's like to play with Donnie McCaslin.
Well, he's a sweetheart. I've known him for...
Really? Yeah.
20 years. Not super well. We were never really close. But we've known each other for a long time. And... he was kind of like one of those young lions. He was playing with Gary Burton.
Mm-hmm.
And then our kids were at school together for a little while. They weren't in the same class, but they were at school together. So we would see each other at drop-off, which is a whole other thing, exhausted in the morning and just kind of picking up, you know, crumbs in the backpack and trying to be firm with the kids. And a couple times we would go out for coffee afterwards and catch up. And we sort of reignited our friendship. And then this was around the time that the Bowie album was coming out, where it came out and Bowie was gone. And he had this huge amount of spotlight on him. And he very compassionately had asked, because he wasn't really a part of the pop world, but I think he had come to he and his beautiful wife, Sarah, and their kids, you know, were all part of the school. So he said, Sarah, and I would love to come to a Steely Dan concert at the Beacon. We want to buy tickets. I said, listen, I'll put you on the guest list. Come on by. And so my wife and Sarah became friendly, and he didn't really have a foot in the pop world. So while all this was happening, he would ask me kind of questions in a way. It was all new, and he was just, it was nonstop for a period. And I would give him whatever advice I felt comfortable with, and then we would talk about collaborating and finding something. And we just kind of struck up this friendship, and then I asked him to record on the album. And there wasn't a huge budget, and he said, I'll do it for whatever, you know, I love your music. And it was so supportive, and there was no ego, that if I thought he was a good guy before, now I was just completely won over. He was a really selfless guy. and just an incredible musician. I mean, tonight at the Standard, Chris Potter's playing.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Now I'm really disappointed that I can't go. Wow. That is amazing.
And Donnie and Chris are, you know, they've done a duo here with Antonio Sanchez, I think, and I saw them here like a little less than a year ago. And they're different players, but what they do have in common is that they have this ability, like I was saying before, over 7, 8, 9, 10 choruses of a song, they can build a solo in a way that doesn't feel scholastic or, you know, they just take it places because of their strength and fluidity on the instrument. If you just let them go, it's like watching a, you know, a tiger run in the wild. It's incredible. So with an orchestra behind them, and the fact that I'm cueing them, there are certain the certain sections that are vamps until I cue different people to come in, and I can arc the backgrounds behind them. For me, it's a joy. But Donnie has been a guest with the orchestra a few times, and now Chris will do it. It's incredible. It's great to hear them in this situation.
How much improvisation are they allowed to do within the context of your composition?
There are a couple, let's say there are 9 to 10 songs in each set. I will typically, when I know the kind of player that they are, there'll be solo sections carved out in a traditional format where the beginning of a composition, whether it's mine or someone else's composition, the melody will be stated. I have the parts designed that if Chris wasn't able to make a rehearsal, he would be able to lay out and then just improvise on the song. There are other pieces that he could just sight read, and it's very simple, and he can just blend in. So half the songs, there's a section to improvise, and he and I are following each other. There are other songs in the book, and my orchestra book now is about 50 to 60 songs in it. So there are 5 or 10 that are completely, have a role of an improviser from beginning to end. And it's all very cinematic. There are drones, I've broken it down into certain parts of the orchestra, first trumpet, bassoon, and accordion are playing the melody, and I'm cueing them. The rest of the orchestra are in a series of vamps. So a couple people are improvising throughout. And that's something that I actually started getting into. I mean, I was always into it in modern 20th century classical music and improvised ensemble music, third string music, Butch Morris, etc. But when I was doing the Nels Klein Lovers album, there were songs that were specifically orchestrated, and there were other songs that were basically free. And the way that Nels and his brother improvised free kind of reignited this love of free jazz, you know, really high-level free jazz. Mm-hmm. If you give someone a framework to paint in, just some amazing things can happen, you know.
Well, that is certainly this album, and I'm so grateful for you taking the time to do this. And I also wanted to, again, talk about you're at the Jazz Standard this evening, and unfortunately, it's only one night, right? So, I mean, if people can't get there tonight, is there another opportunity to hear you doing this?
Yes, we'll be back here February 12th for our Valentine's Day show. So this is the beginning of our monthly residency. We're doing, I think it winds up being the second Tuesday or the third Tuesday in every month. And there's a different sort of theme to each one. Tonight we have Chris Potter as a guest, and we're actually going into the studio this Sunday to record the next orchestra album for Sunnyside Records, which will be, it's called Sweet Extracts, Volume 1. And it'll be extracts from like little pieces of all the covers suites. So the first album was an original, with all original compositions. This next one will be all covers, but my arrangements of them.
Okay, so I have to ask, covers of what? Or is that not?
No, because you'll see it online. We're doing, here are some of the suites. We have a Spinal Tap suite. We have a Charlie Brown Peanut suite.
That's hilarious. Okay.
We have, I don't know if you'd call it an Ornette Coleman suite, but that's in there. There's a Horace Silver suite. There is the Wu-Tang Clan suite. There's the Psycho suite, Bernard Herrmann's score to Psycho.
Sounds fabulous, yeah.
Suite. That's a doozy to rehearse, but it's worth it. The Chess suite, which is was inspired by my son's love of chess, which has since transferred to soccer. But so it's hinting at chess, but it's really Chess Records and Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf.
Fabulous.
And then there is also, let's see, what was the last one? The 1970s Film Score Suite, which has some cues from some rare cues by Nino Rota for Godfather 2, and some Lalo Schifrin. I mean, there's no shortage of stuff. So we're going to go in and record about 20 pieces, and then just take probably 11 or 12 and use them for the first volume one. So
it sounds fascinating, and it sounds a little bad. Pluses, you know, a little bit, right?
Yeah, that's right. Sort of, yeah. Isn't that right? It's the dissecting and taking music cross-genre and just ripping it apart, yeah.
Yeah, I've enjoyed that, I have to say. You know, I mean, I used to, I think, be a little bit more of a jazz protector, if it will. You know, that whole jazz fusion idea was never really a happy place for me, you know. But lately, I have had to say, you know, I mean, Robert Glasper and this whole other crew of young musicians that are taking us in these interesting directions that I think that it would be very small-minded not to acknowledge that that's pretty spectacular also.
You know, it's not everyone's cup of tea. I mean, we also had the Afrobeat Suite, which I forgot, which is a couple pieces by Fela Kuti, which to me is, when I hear that, it's a variation on jazz. It's with the drummer, I mean, the pocket coming out of James Brown, but I had the same feel in my body as when I hear jazz. Just the feel from Tony Allen, the drummer, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're going to do that as well. So,
it sounds spectacular.
With everything. Yeah.
All right, well, so I'm going to let you, I'm assuming you have to practice.
We are loading, and I see the musicians walking in.
Yes, because practice makes perfect and gets you to Carnegie Hall, right?
Perhaps.
Yeah. Just kidding. So it's been a pleasure, and I'm going to be giving away some tickets, so hopefully somebody will show up with a WPKN t-shirt, and you can give them a wave if you're able.
Great.
And,
say hi.
And I will try and get some tickets to give away for your upcoming shows. Are you at the Jazz Standard every month for, like, the next 12 months? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's it.
That's fabulous. All right. So certainly I'll be there at some point. And I just wanted to thank you again for your time. And I do want to tell you, you'll be happy to know, we're about to play some music from your new album. But then we also have some of your dad's music as well. So he is going to get a little airtime also.
Good. That's good stuff.
Fabulous.
So, what are you playing with it?
I have a couple of things thrown in the playlist, so I haven't decided yet, but one is with Ken Poplowski, so I'm looking forward to it. We'll see. So, listen, have a wonderful show, and I thank you again, and I hope that you'll come back. We would really enjoy talking to you about your next album.
Anytime.
Fabulous. Thank you so much.
Great. Okay. Have a good day.
So that is Michael Leonhardt, yeah, and we're going to hear a little bit more of his music, and we're going to hear his dad's music, and I am going to give some tickets away. Now, full disclosure before we start this process, right, these are Jazz Standard tickets. Jazz Standard is in New York City, and they are for tonight. So you would have to make a commitment to go down to the city sometime between now and either 7:30 or 9:30. But if you're able to get down there, I have two pairs of tickets, and which would mean you and a guest. So if you're interested in that, as soon as I get off the air, you can call 203-331-9756. I'll give that to you again. And of course, this is a number to call PKN. And the reason that I'm able to give away tickets is because of you and your support. So always remember that. The number here to call, get your pencil out, is 203-331-9756. I have tickets available for Michael Leonhardt at the Jazz Standard this evening. You can go at 7:30 or at 9:30. Two pairs of tickets, you and a guest. And we're going to continue here at your radio station. And this is the man, Michael Leonhardt.